the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take 2, May Martinez. Election Day just 3 weeks away. Now, in case you haven't put pen to paper on your ballot because you have one or two questions, well, that's what we're here for. And of course, we have an expert with all the answers. Plus, Compton has got a vertical farm, nearly 100,000 square feet of leafy greens being watched over by robots. Find out all about it ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. So glad to have you with us. Coming up, a lot of Californians have moved to Texas in recent years, and the influx might be making the Lone Star State a bit more purple.
There's something about the way they walk or something. I usually say, are you from California? And 99% of the time, I'm right. Okay.
That's a Texas County Democratic chair, by the way. We'll hear more about that just ahead, by the way. Yesterday, my wife said the word grip, but she said it grip. She said it just like West Texas style. It was one of the coolest things I've heard her say in a long time. We're going to start the show, though, right here with the election in the Golden State. The first in-person vote centers will open in Los Angeles and Orange counties in a couple of weeks. And many people have already started to fill out their mail-in ballots. But where to drop those off? I mean, if you'd rather not mail them in. That is the big question this week, as there are some shenanigans afoot. Every Tuesday leading up to Election Day, we're checking in with senior politics reporter Libby Denkman on the latest election news. And yesterday, Libby, Secretary of State Alex Padilla and Attorney General Javier Becerra sent cease and desist letters to the state Republican Party. Election officials say the GOP has to remove fake ballot drop boxes marked as, quote, official, which, as we heard on the show yesterday, are not official and started to appear throughout the state. Libby, remind us what's going on.
So we started getting reports over the weekend that there were filing cabinets popping up outside churches and retail outlets in Orange, Los Angeles, Ventura, and Fresno counties. They had signs, some of them, that said official ballot drop box, and some local officials were encouraging people to use them to turn in their ballots. Eventually, the state GOP and some local chapters said, yep, those are ours, but they defended the operation as legal under the state's ballot harvesting law.
Are they legal, though?
The short answer is no. It's true that ballot harvesting is legal in California. That was signed into law in 2016. It used to be that if somebody else was going to turn in your ballot, they had to be related to you or in your household. But now you are allowed to hand over your ballot to a volunteer with a political party or a nonprofit organization. But that process involves designating a specific person who can't be paid and has to turn in your ballot within 72 hours. And that person also has to sign your ballot. So dropping something into a filing cabinet at the front desk of your gym doesn't fall under that ballot collection law. Yesterday, Secretary of State Alex Padilla and Attorney General Javier Becerra sent cease and desist letters to the state party. Padilla says the unauthorized boxes are illegal and the Republican Party must remove them by Thursday.
These boxes are not the same as county election drop boxes that are required to meet state security standards, as well as other regulations, including the regular retrieval of ballots delivered to those drop boxes by voters.
And Becerra suggested there could be legal charges if the party does not comply.
I'm trying to be careful with how I say this, but the reports that we are hearing are disturbing. It is illegal, but more than just illegal, it is irresponsible to tamper with a citizen's vote.
Violating the state's election code in this way carries a penalty of up to 4 years in prison,
4 years, wow. All right. Well, what happens next? I mean, are any charges going to be filed?
Nothing yet, and Secretary Padilla said he believes most of the boxes are being removed. But an email I received from a state GOP spokesman is unclear about this. He said the party will continue its ballot harvesting operation and, quote, not allow the Secretary of State to suppress the vote. So we'll see if they dig in and state officials end up stepping in.
Now, as we do every election, the Voter Game Plan team is answering your questions about voting at votergameplan.com. Libby, what are some of the questions you're seeing coming in from the audience?
First up, and I did not expect this one at all, people want to know what they should do with somebody else's ballot or a second ballot. Because of the expansion of vote by mail, every active registered voter in the state is getting a ballot in the mail. But that means there are some misfires. Some people told us they got more than one ballot with their name on it. Others opened up their mailboxes to find ballots for people who no longer live there, former roommates, previous tenants of their apartments, or relatives who have died. Here's the thing. Election officials do update their voter rolls using death records and change of address forms from the DMV, but the registrars need the public's help to get the most current information. And a quick note, you cannot vote twice, and a second ballot that you cast with your name on it would be invalidated anyway.
So what should you do, though, with an extra ballot?
Well, in LA and Ventura County's elections officials recommend dropping the envelope back in the mail marked not at this address, return to sender. In Orange County, Registrar Neil Kelly advises you discard that unwanted ballot and let your county know about the mistake. Obviously, again, you can't vote twice. That's illegal and it wouldn't work anyway.
Now, Libby, you have a live event coming up tomorrow. You're moderating a debate between the candidates for LA County's 2nd Supervisorial District, right?
Yes, it's at 6:30 tomorrow, and this is Mark Ridley Thomas's seat, who is termed out and is now running for LA City Council. It's a rare open seat on LA County's governing board, and there's a ton at stake. State Senator Holly Mitchell is facing termed out City Council member Herb Wesson. They both want to join the Board of Supervisors, which is a group only half-jokingly dubbed Five Little Kings, and more recently Queens, because of the scope of their powers and how safe their seats are once elected. The second district includes parts of West LA County. That's cities like Carson, Compton, Culver City, Inglewood, neighborhoods like Crenshaw, parts of Koreatown, La Brea, Mar Vista. About 2 million people live there, and the board oversees a $35 billion budget. And this race was very close in the primary. They were separated by just 2,700 votes.
So what are the big issues at play?
Well, housing and homelessness is always at the top of the list, and it's very important to voters in the second district. But this year, especially, policing and criminal justice reform is the big issue all over Los Angeles. And the second district has seen two high-profile police killings in recent months. Andres Guardado and Dijon Kizzy, both shot by deputies with the LA County Sheriff's Department. So this issue hits close to home for voters and these campaigns. Herb Wesson and Holly Mitchell each say they are the correct choice to reform LA County law enforcement and fix systemic problems in the criminal justice system. After the killing of George Floyd and rising calls to defund the LAPD, Wesson helped introduce the LA City Council motion that ultimately cut $150 million from the LAPD budget. Los Angeles is also moving ahead with piloting a plan, which Wesson championed, to create a program for unarmed response to some nonviolent 911 calls in the city. He said he is at, quote, the tip of the spear in reimagining public safety.
Tip of the spear. Well, okay, that's quite a claim. I'm sure his opponent has something to say about that.
She does. Holly Mitchell says she has been introducing reforms in the legislature her whole career, and she suggests Wesson's recent actions are political opportunism. She has authored several criminal justice and juvenile justice reform bills, including a law that bans life sentences without the possibility for parole in juveniles. Her quote is that she's been working on changing the system, not just when it's been cool and everybody's doing it. Back when it was difficult, when the police unions and the District Attorneys Association fought me every step along the way. Mitchell also authored legislation to shrink the sentencing differences between powder and crack cocaine and to limit what police can seize from people who haven't been convicted of a crime. And Wesson has drawn criticism for pushing through a change to city law that relaxed police accountability. Charter Amendment C was on the May 2017 ballot. It was requested by the union that represents LAPD officers. It allows officers accused of misconduct to choose to have an all-civilian review board look at their case instead of one including high-ranking members of their department. Civilians rule in favor of officers more often, than experienced commanders and captains. So that has been evidence to his critics that Wesson has only worked to rein in the LAPD lately when he was thinking about his political future. But he has won the endorsement of some influential Black Lives Matter LA leaders like Malina Abdullah, who have worked with him on ideas to minimize the role of LAPD.
That's Libby Denkman, KPCC's senior politics reporter, and check out our election guides and voting resources online at votergameplan.com. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, as we mentioned, Libby is moderating a debate tomorrow night between former LA City Council President Herb Wesson and State Senator Holly Mitchell. They are both vying for the job of LA County Supervisor. We'll hear from the candidates starting at 6:30, and you can still RSVP at kpcc.org/events. All right, staying with politics, one big measure on the ballot this November is Prop 15. It aims to raise about $11 billion a year for California schools and local governments, and that money would come from raising taxes on commercial properties, especially ones that haven't changed hands for years. KPCC's David Wagner wanted to know what this would mean for one well-known and long-held business in Orange County, so he takes us on a trip to the mall.
South Coast Plaza isn't like other malls. It's unapologetically upscale. With coronavirus restrictions in place, shoppers now have to line up to get inside boutiques like Gucci and Louis Vuitton. Karen Watson came to pick up a piece of jewelry from Chanel.
Certain stores you're not going to get in. Tiffany's is another one. You're going to have to wait.
Another way the mall is unique, it's been privately held by the same family for more than 50 years. The Sagerstroms built South Coast Plaza on a lima bean farm in the 1960s, and they've maintained ownership ever since. USC researcher Jennifer Ito says under current state law, the longer you own commercial property, the lower your property taxes.
Under Prop 13, the kinds of businesses that get the most benefit are those that bought their properties years ago.
Prop 13 was a tax-cutting measure passed by California voters more than 40 years ago. And under Prop 13, businesses don't pay taxes on what their properties are worth today. Generally, their taxes are based on what they paid for the property, even if they bought it decades ago.
There are some that have not been reassessed since Prop 13 passed, and so they were last assessed at their market value in 1975.
But this election, California voters are being asked to overturn parts of Prop 13. The new measure, Prop 15, would tax larger commercial properties according to their current market value. UCLA tax law professor Kirk Stark says that could have a big impact on older legacy businesses.
I think the South Coast Plaza is a good example of a situation where property tax burden could increase very substantially.
A South Coast Plaza representative declined to be interviewed for this story. But we do know that C.J. Sagerstrom & Sons has donated more than $500,000 to a political action committee opposing Prop 15. So how much could the mall's property taxes go up if voters pass it?
I would say it's really difficult to determine.
Stark says first, you would need to know the mall's current market value. There are estimates out there. One local real estate analytics firm estimates the Sagerstrom family's business assets at $2 billion based on their ownership of this one mall. That's four times higher than the current assessed value of all the properties associated with the mall's address, according to Orange County property tax records. But is the mall really worth four times its current assessed value? Stark says that's unclear.
The only way you can figure out the value of anything is if there's a sale.
Without that, all we have are independent estimates. And Stark says those estimates may be looking at factors like the mall's brand and existing customer base, which have nothing to do with the value of the physical property itself.
You know, will it be doubled, tripled, quadrupled as a result of Prop 15? I don't know the exact number.
At the end of the day, the Orange County Assessor's Office would have to make that call. But one thing is clear. Right now, some parts of this mall are paying much less than others. For example, I'm in the parking lot right now looking at the Macy's Men's Store, which hasn't been reassessed for 25 years. Right next to it, there's a Saks Fifth Avenue. They're pretty similar buildings. They're both blocky, three-story department stores built in the late 70s. But the Saks was reassessed much more recently, in 2016. That goes a long way toward explaining why its tax bill is nearly five times higher than the bill for the Macy's Men's Store.
This particular reform really goes to the heart of the issue of equity.
Mark Moffitt with the University of North Texas says under Prop 15, property taxes would be based on what both department stores are actually worth today.
It will provide a level playing field for both to make sure that they're being valued similarly and being subject to similar tax liability.
But business groups say there's nothing unfair about the current rules. They say Prop 13 provides certainty and encourages long-term investment. California Business Roundtable President Rob Lapsley says stripping away those protections wouldn't just hit large corporations.
Because if you increase cost for South Coast Plaza, the tenants of South Coast Plaza are going to pay for it, and they are in turn going to pass on all of the costs to the consumers.
But USC sociology professor Manuel Pastor says older businesses are getting big discounts, while their newer competitors face higher costs.
I am not sure if someone could have devised a more dysfunctional tax system than the one that's been put in place by Prop 13, in which you've got identical pieces of property right next to one another paying wildly different property tax bills.
Pastor says because of that, schools and local governments are losing out on about $11 billion per year in tax revenue. Whether or not businesses are paying their fair share will, once again, be up to voters to decide. Covering the economy, I'm David Wagner.
All right, we've mentioned it more than a few times the last few months, but black and brown Angelenos have been the hardest hit groups during the pandemic in just about every way. Death rates for these two groups are twice to four times as high than whites. And working in warehouses doesn't help, but things and the numbers are changing for the better. And it all because people are talking about it. We'll tell you why when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. By now, it's no secret that black and Latino residents in lower income communities have been among the hardest hit by the coronavirus in L.A. County. During the height of transmission in July, Latinos in L.A. were dying at a rate more than four times higher than that of whites. Black people were twice as likely as white people to die of the disease. But over the past couple of months, those stats have begun to change, actually for the better. The COVID-19 death and case rates among blacks and Latinos has actually declined. And LA County officials say it has something to do with aggressive workplace health enforcement and empowering workers to monitor their places of employment, which includes anonymous tip lines to report violations. Ana Almendrala is a correspondent with Kaiser Health News and has been covering California's most vulnerable communities throughout the pandemic. Let's start with the numbers, Ana. How do the COVID-19 case and death rates among black and Latino people in LA County compare now to white people?
Well, as you said, during the summer surge, Latinos were dying at a rate of more than four times that of whites. Blacks were dying at a rate of twice that of whites. By mid-September, which is the latest age-adjusted data we have available, death rates among both blacks and Latinos have fallen by more than half, and they're approaching the rate for whites. Now, when it comes to case counts, there were more than four times as many positive cases among Latinos than whites in late July. But now, well, actually, by mid-September, the Latino case rates are only 64% higher. And the positivity rate among blacks was about 60% higher than that of whites in late July, but the disparity seems to have waned by mid-September.
How do we know that the difference comes from workplace changes? I mean, what tells us that people were contracting the virus from where they work?
Well, experts don't know for sure that workplace transmission was responsible for the summer surge in LA. I mean, remember, in addition to reopening the economy, which is something that happened statewide, those cases were also a few weeks after Memorial Day weekend, which, as you know, had a lot of family gatherings and get-togethers. But what LA County can say is that workplace investigations have found clusters of cases in workplaces, which then get transmitted back to communities in the form of overcrowded housing, inability to isolate or quarantine. And we also know about the virus itself, which can be transmitted via droplets or maybe even aerosols. Now, that means that people are at a higher risk of infection the longer that they stay indoors with others who are infectious. They're also at a higher risk of infection the closer they are to somebody. So that means that workplace transmission is a really plausible way for these cases to spread.
When it comes to workplace health enforcement, what does that entail exactly? And who's doing the enforcing?
Yeah, well, what we know is that LA County Public Health Department issues a health officer order, which is, you know, we'll say something like, in order to open your retail store, you need to provide masks to all of your employees, Customers who enter also have to be masked, and everyone needs to stay 6 feet social distance. What we know is that there is a hotline that workers can call or a form that they can fill out on the internet to lodge an anonymous complaint about their workplace. Then a public health investigator will hopefully come out to visit that workplace and assess the measures that are being taken to comply with the health officer order. However, there are only a little less than 400 investigators for the entirety of LA County. So that means, you know, we have a population of about 10 million people. And before the pandemic, there were more than 240,000 registered businesses. So they're really spread thin. Dr. Ferrer has said that these investigators have been working overtime for a long time.
Now, the county officials, when they say that we're seeing these declines now, were workplace health protocols just not being enforced before when COVID-19 cases were at their peak in July?
That could be the case. I mean, in addition to the summer surge, before the summer surge, there was this period of success. Maybe people were feeling that maybe this virus isn't so transmissible. Maybe they were feeling overconfident about their ability to stay away from infections. Whatever the case was, after the summer surge, Dr. Ferrer realized that, hey, workplace needs to be our top priority. And even before the summer surge, knowing about the racial disparities as early as April, I mean, LA was one of the first jurisdictions to call attention to those racial disparities. They knew that Blacks and Latinos were more likely to be classed as essential workers and working in areas where they have the least protections and have to be in the most confined spaces with other employees or customers.
Did the county kind of just leave it up to individual businesses to create and implement their health protocols on this?
What Dr. Ferrer told me was that at the beginning of the pandemic, the County Board of Supervisors were sending business leaders to the Department of Health to sort of work with them on what are reasonable practices, what are reasonable things that we should all be doing together. And as the pandemic wore on, Dr. Ferrer realized that she needed to more seriously involve labor. Now, she says that now we're very explicit about talking to labor. We have dedicated lines for labor. But when it first started, they were mostly talking to business sectors.
Talking to Anna Almendrala, correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Wondering how much is this change also about empowering the employees? I mean, you write that LA County officials want to create workplace councils at businesses to have employees trained to look for COVID-19 prevention violations and then report them without fear of being fired or punished. The LA County Board of Supervisors is expected to approve an ordinance to pass this policy this month. How did the plan come about?
Dr. Ferrer is extremely, extremely excited about this proposal. What she noticed is that especially at shops or factories where the workers are not unionized, the employees needed a way to be able to gather together and air their concerns about the health order violations without fear of being fired or having their hours reduced. This was actually inspired by the negative experiences of another factory in Los Angeles. It's called Overhill Farms. They make frozen food, and it's in Vernon. I spoke to labor experts who said that they also had an outbreak of more than 20 cases and one death. They actually were also hit with more than $200,000 in proposed penalties from Cal OSHA. But before the fines had landed, the factory leadership there was already responding by beginning to hold meetings to improve the safety there.
So this plan, what would it look like? How would it work?
Well, we're not sure yet, but labor and economy researchers who have studied the plan, like Tia Kuntz from UCLA, she says that, probably it would take no more than 10% of a workforce or no less than two people to spend a couple hours a week going over any concerns that need to be addressed about violations. And this is not a program where the employees, they envision that the employees go running to the health department immediately. This is something where they are envisioning open communication between employees who are on the shop floor, they're on the ground. They're the ones best suited to know what's happening, with customer behavior or how difficult or easy it is to do the work while still being safe. And then, sort of bringing their concerns and suggestions for improvement to management. And, optimally, management would like to have these councils because it's a way for them to protect their employees, their customers, and to continue operating their business as the economy continues to open up.
So that's an ideal situation. But Anna, we know business leaders sometimes when problems emerge, they don't want to either know about it or do much about it. So what have labor groups and others have to say about the implementation of these workplace councils?
Well, you know, if workers feel like their managers are not listening to them, they also have the option of approaching a third party organization. This is another part of the proposal, which is that a community-based organization would contract with the county to, you know, help train and educate employees about how to talk about violations. And if the violations continue to go unaddressed, employees can go to these third-party companies to sort of help them file a formal complaint to the public health department.
That's Anna Amendrala, correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
You can read more about this story on laist.com. That's laist.com. It's unnatural for Texas and California to be rivals. They're the two most populous states in the U.S. They're also the biggest in the contiguous 48. But while it used to be that folks dreamt of moving to the West Coast, lately, the Lone Star State has been stealing some of California's golden shine. We'll find out more about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us. From an empty sea, a flash of light. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm A. Martinez. Pushed by the high cost of living, more than 700,000 Californians have moved to Texas since 2008. It's part of the reason historically bright red Texas has turned surprisingly purple in 2020. Polls show President Trump with only a narrow lead over Democratic challenger Joe Biden. Matt Levin of the nonprofit news site Cal Matters catches up with one LA expat tilting Texas more blue.
When Dr. Maisha Taylor saw her Biden-Harris lawn sign was missing from the front yard, she did what any parent would do. She blamed her kids.
And they were like, we didn't touch it. I don't know. Nobody knows anything, right? I said, well, I'm going to rewind these cameras. Let's rewind the cameras. We can see exactly what happened to the sign.
Taylor and her husband sat their three children down to scour through the security tape. It was like family movie night, with the added intrigue that someone in the audience might be guilty.
And we're watching, and then we see the car come up and turn on our street and then stop. And we're like, wait, why are they stopping in front of our house?
It's nighttime and the camera is pretty far away, but it's clear what's happening. Somebody gets out of the passenger seat, jumps on Taylor's retaining wall, and takes the Biden-Harris sign.
You're just standing there like, I cannot believe this actually happened, right? I'm from California. Like, I never would have thought that Trump would have won. And I'm thinking, who voted for this guy? Then I moved here and I realized who voted for this guy, right?
Here for Taylor is Tarrant County, Texas, home to Fort Worth, Arlington, and an endless stretch of freshly subdivided bedroom communities. Over the past decade, those bedrooms have been filled by a steady stream of Californians lured by a booming economy and cheap homes. Taylor hasn't solved the case of the Great Lawn Sign heist just yet. But one possible motive? Fear that Texas, home of Ted Cruz and George W. Bush and open carry gun laws, could actually vote for a Democrat this year.
Trump has fairly consistently led over the last few months, but really in the most recent polling by 5 points or less, and there have even been a few polls that have had the race even or within one or two.
Jim Henson is a professor and pollster at the University of Texas at Austin. He says the tight presidential race shouldn't surprise anyone who has been paying attention to Texas politics over the last decade. In 2018, Democrat Beto O'Rourke lost to Senator Ted Cruz by only a few percentage points. Henson says it's a mistake to say Texas is trending blue just because of California expats. But he says recent transplants are reshaping the politics of Texas suburbs. It's why you won't find a bigger fan of Californians than Deborah Peoples, chair of the Tarrant County Democratic Party. Many of her new volunteers have come from Southern California or the Bay Area.
There's something about the way they walk or something. I usually say, are you from California? And 99% of the time, I'm right. Okay.
Historically, Tarrant County has been a Republican stronghold. Lyndon Johnson was the last Democratic presidential candidate to win it. But national Democrats are for the first time in decades pouring money into the county, hoping they can finally flip it for Biden and win some congressional seats along the way.
I think we're seeing this level of activism among Californians. When they get here, they look at the political landscape, they say, this doesn't look like where I came from, and what do I do to change it?
The Texas GOP is not rolling out the welcome mat. Like Trump, they're using California's problems, exorbitant home prices, homelessness, to mobilize their own voters. Don't California My Texas was a campaign slogan for the Republican governor. Dr. Myesha Taylor says some of the anti-California rhetoric has a grain of truth to it. And she loves some parts of living in Texas. It's been her home for the past 11 years. So after all that time, does she consider herself more a Texan or a Californian now?
Oh, Californian. I'm just living in Texas right now.
In Sacramento, I'm Matt Levin.
All right, now back to Los Angeles. After saying it would hold its annual convention at the LA Convention Center in person in December, the organizers of LA Comic-Con said they will now push it to next September. All right, so what happened? LAist's Mike Rowe has been following the whole thing. Mike, we just talked about how the show would go on at LA Comic-Con, so why the reversal?
Yeah, it was just 2 weeks ago that LA Comic-Con announced they were putting tickets on sale for a December convention, maybe like the first event back in person. But now they're pushing it back more than 9 months. They're blaming Governor Newsom's decision to cancel plans to issue guidelines for reopening theme parks next month, very soon. And they believe that issuing those guidelines for bringing back those live events would follow after allowing a large theme park like Disneyland to reopen. But now there's no theme park guidelines and no live event guidelines.
All right. But even if amusement parks were, say, allowed to be open, how would LA Comic-Con, an event indoors, been able to pull that off?
I mean, they met with the LA Convention Center and LA Public Health. They wanted to find out what the plans were for reopening and tried setting up their own restrictions around what they thought those guidelines were going to be. Those include the limiting capacity to 25%, having cleaning guidelines, social distancing, requiring masks. They had also planned to rent out the entire convention center, while in previous years they just had rented part of the center to allow for more room for social distancing. But now, without those guidelines coming to be, whether or not they matched what the organizers thought they would be, there's no way for them to hold that event.
I mean, Mike, not that I was, waiting for tickets to go on sale or anything like that, but, why announce a December convention, put tickets on sale in the first place before getting all the approvals, before dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of folks agree with that. There was a lot of pushback on social media as far as how safe this could be, even with restrictions at this point. But according to the convention CEO, they needed to be able to start selling tickets at some point for their December event. And they'd already pushed back the convention from September to December. This was sort of the last date available on the calendar that they could do it while still keeping it in this year. There's also been some speculation online about the company trying to make some money at this point, knowing it was unlikely to pull this event off. But the company's CEO told me that they are planning on either rolling over tickets next year if that's what people want, or they will give people a full refund if they ask for one.
And speaking of amusement parks, I know Governor Gavin Newsom announced yesterday that he would send a group to the now open Disney World in Florida to get a little intel on how it might work at Disneyland here in Anaheim. What's the plan there? I mean, do we know when that trip might happen?
Yeah, it sounds like those trips are happening this week. You know, we haven't received a lot of details, but it also seems like there's a possibility the governor may send teams to other theme parks to report back, see how COVID-19 reopening restrictions are being put into place at different theme parks, and also how their situations might be different from what's being faced both by large theme parks like Disneyland as well as smaller theme parks here in California.
I mean, I guess it's Disneyland over there. It's Disneyland over here. I guess it's kind of, I guess, the same thing, I suppose.
Close.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's close. Now, and what's the latest word on Newsom when it comes to those parks and larger events? It seems like he isn't really in any rush, which is annoying city officials wherever these parks are operating, right?
Yeah, I mean, the governor's team did circulate draft guidelines a couple weeks ago. They were planning to release those, but, you know, the theme park industry started pushing back. According to the Wall Street Journal, those plans wouldn't have allowed theme parks to reopen until counties were in the safest of the four COVID-19 reopening tiers. And even then, they would still have to be at 25% capacity. So I think that, you know, theme park industry felt that that wasn't doable, that they couldn't really make money in the long term, especially without having any idea when they'd be able to have a greater capacity, so that those plans just went out the window, and now there's no reopening guidelines, at least for the moment.
Mike, you're a comic book guy. I know you also like theme parks and amusement parks. Generally, in your circle of people that you go with to these things, what's been the thought on getting these things open? Are they patient or are they just like impatient? They want to just get them open so they can have something to do.
Yeah, you know, I think that fans are trying to be patient right now. You know, a lot of conventions have been experimenting with online panels and things like that. Like Comic-Con did that this summer. And LA Comic-Con says that they are planning on having some online things, even if they do go back in person. So that, you know, I think it's going to create new experiences. But there's also the whole live event experience that you can't really recreate online.
Something's better than nothing, though. That's LA's Mike Rowe. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to the playground. The yellow caution tape that surrounded many of LA's playgrounds at the start of the coronavirus pandemic disappeared this month after the state issued new safety guidelines. KPCC's early childhood reporter Mariana Dale brings us an audio postcard of one family's first outing to the jungle gym in more than 6 months.
Oh, let's go and play!
My name is Franilyn Dacono. We are here at the playground of El Carrizo Park in Celmar, and I'm with my husband and my son. He's 3 years old, and he's Francis.
How about you climb that one and do the slide?
Your turn.
Maybe I can come down if I'm very careful.
He's like trying to release all his energy. What dinosaur are you?
I'm a T-Rex.
A T-Rex?
There's so many teams.
This has been part of our daily life, and we're really happy and grateful that it's open again.
All right, if you were to drive around LA with the goal of finding a farm, a working farm, it may be tough. Yeah, there are a few spots here and there, but you'd have more luck finding a farm if you head out of the LA area, except if you drive through Compton. The city has a long history of agriculture, but if you were to try and find their newest, biggest farm, you wouldn't find it. But we'll tell you how when Take Two continues.
Brown and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be saving more if I was in LA.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and most places where you find your podcasts. I'm Ian Martinez. All right, let's head to Compton, where a 95,000-square-foot vertical farming facility is underway. The operation will be home to rows and rows of leafy greens, LED lights, and even some robots. The company behind the facility is a San Francisco startup named Plenty, which has received money from several high-profile people, such as Alphabet chairman Eric Schmidt and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Now, if you're wondering how it's all going to work, we have some answers. Here to break it down is Stefan Slater, a freelance writer who recently wrote a piece about the vertical farming facility for our website, LAist, and also Rachel Searles. She's a sustainable food systems advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension in LA County. All right, Stefan, let's start with you. Can you tell us what the Compton vertical farm will look like once completed?
So the Compton facility, which is still under construction and hopefully will be opening and moving forward next year. So if you were to walk in, what you would see would be something like a science fiction story. You would see these large towers, these 20-foot tall hydroponic vertical grow towers full of leafy greens. They're packed together so closely that they almost look like an entire living wall of emerald green. And with Plenty in their particular approach within their grow room is they make sure that people aren't really interacting with the greens as they're growing. So that's where the robots come in. The robots are actually manipulating these towers. They're moving them along. And so Plenty claims that because there's so little interaction, that people aren't really handling the greens as much, that they're able to grow an environment that they believe is pristine. So that means no pesticides, that the greens don't need to be washed. And so once the plants are done growing in these big, tall towers, these robots actually pick up the towers and move them along to the end of this process where they are then harvested and packaged and then, shipped off, and all within one particular facility.
Rachel, let's zoom out on this a bit, because I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about vertical farms as a form of urban agriculture and what kinds of issues these facilities could potentially address.
Vertical farming is not new, but it's sort of come to the forefront in about the last decade. So I'm part of a team at University of California that has looked at urban farming around the state, and I've looked at it to a certain extent nationally as well. Most urban farms in the U.S. are not high tech. They're in the ground, in the soil, and they're often run by nonprofit organizations that are addressing things like food insecurity, which is a huge and growing problem in the nation. So vertical farms are part of this whole urban agriculture landscape. There used to be very few. There's still relatively few, but they're increasing in number as new technologies advance. And they are obviously, they're a type of indoor agriculture, which we call controlled environment agriculture, where everything can be very carefully climate controlled. Everything can be produced very, very efficiently. These kinds of farms have very high startup costs. So they are usually part of for-profit companies. They often have angel investors. They cost a lot to get started, but produce can be grown very efficiently. Unlike many of the nonprofit urban farms that are geared towards getting fresh produce to communities that need it, or job training or community building, these types of vertical urban farms tend to be focused on enhancing the profit margin, because farming is a low profit margin business. So they're trying to make it as efficient as possible so they can have a successful business model. And that usually means selling the produce to high-end restaurants and to higher-end grocery retail.
We always hear the term farm to table, but often that farm is hundreds of miles away from the table that it eventually winds up in, that the produce winds up in. Could this be a case, Rachel, where when it comes to farm to table, the farm is almost next door to the table?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is really cool to have an urban farm like the one we're talking about right in Compton, which is in the heart of urban Los Angeles, where certainly we need more food, fresh food. I think the question for me, and this is what I recommend to everybody who gets excited about urban agriculture, we have to think critically about it. We have to look at projects like this as not automatically improving the food security just because they're built in a certain location. They have that potential, but there has to be a lot of work on behalf of building those bridges in the community. On the other hand, we do see that farms like this produce very fresh produce. It gets right to the market.
Stefan, why did the company decide to bring this to Compton in the first place?
It's part of their overarching goal. Plenty wants to build at least 500 of these vertical farms around the planet, especially in densely populated cities of at least a million people. So their first farm is in South San Francisco. And for their second act, they wanted to come down to Los Angeles. And so they chose Compton. And the reason for that is that Compton has a longstanding history, a connection with agriculture. In particular, if you look at a part of Compton known as the Richland Farms neighborhood, it's traditionally going back to the late 1800s. It's a part of Compton where people have been farming for a very, very long time. And even currently, it's home for the Compton Cowboys. It's still a part of Compton where you can grow crops. You have enough space to do it. So really for Plenty, it was a way to, you know, come into an urban area to connect with the local community, but to also connect with one that really has a longstanding history of agriculture as well.
Rachel, you actually co-authored a book about the history of agriculture in LA called From Cows to Concrete, The Rise and Fall of Farming in Los Angeles. And Stefan mentioned it a bit, but can you briefly walk us through Compton's agricultural past?
Compton was formed by a group of people who set about immediately to farming it. Even before that, it had been a gigantic rancho, part of a big cattle ranch. And before that, it was part of the Los Angeles region's rich indigenous history, where there were abundant food sources like acorns and all kinds of edible plants. People grew all kinds of things in Compton, vegetables, fruit trees. There were many, many dairies and poultry farms in Compton. And it wasn't until probably the 1920s that Compton really started to become more of a city rather than a rural environment.
Now, according to a recent study out of USC, more than one in four LA County households experienced food insecurity from April to July of this year during the pandemic. Rachel, I know you touched on this before, but could a facility like this in a neighborhood experiencing food insecurity help provide consistent access to food that's healthy and good for them?
Well, it could, but that's not just going to happen automatically. A farm like this has a limited palette of what they can grow, first of all, because of the nature of vertical farming, where you're basically producing flat trays and they're stacked up on top of each other. You're growing things like salad greens and baby kale and edible flowers. And so that's for a certain clientele, like restaurant chefs. So could this produce help to support hungry families in Los Angeles? I would say it definitely could, but it takes intentionality on the part of the business that's leading this effort, in this case, Plenty. So I'd love to see Plenty develop partnerships with people who are already out there doing food insecurity work.
Stefan, did Plenty lay out goals to work with the community? And what's been the community's response? Because I know you spoke with Compton Mayor Asia Brown on this.
The response so far has been pretty positive. After speaking with the mayor and going back and forth with Plenty, it does really seem that Plenty is invested in Compton. You know, I do know that they're going to be working to hire locally. I know that after speaking with the mayor, that there's going to be an effort to connect Plenty in the facility with local schools to really try to introduce, local children to just this concept of vertical farming and to the technology that they're developing. This is a nascent technology. It is something that is relatively new at a commercial level. And so the hope is to see how Compton can really kind of take charge here and get involved with this facility and also with this technology.
That's Stefan Slater, freelance writer who recently wrote The Farm of the Future Might Be in Compton, inside a warehouse and run partly by robots, for our website, LAist, and also Rachel Searles, Sustainable Food Systems Advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension in LA County. Stefan and Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read more about this story on LAist.com. That's LAIST.com. All right. If you missed any part of Take Two today, I mean, today's show, I think I can honestly say second best Take Two of the week, right? Second best show of the week so far. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.